Shalom, this is Brad Scott with the Wild Branch Ministry, and for what it's worth to any of you out there, I just wanted to take this time to just get a little informal for a minute. There's nothing formal about this message. I just want to sit back and talk about some things for a few minutes, give my perspective on it, like I said, for what it's worth to any of you, as to what is going on in these precarious times. And we do indeed live in very precarious times. Most of you are well aware of that. And that's why we're talking about this. I am as concerned about what is going on as many of you are. For one of the biggest concerns right now is not what, give me a Bible verse that I can read and so forth. I think we're to the point, no disrespect, obviously, to the Torah and so forth, to the scriptures. But it's a time of action and people want to know what to do. And so I would like to address some of those things for just a few minutes with you. As if it's Erev Shabbat and we're sitting in your house, sitting on the couch talking about world events and so forth. I remember several years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, in the preparation process for the Esau series, spent quite a bit of time going through the details of the lives of Cain, Ishmael, and Esau, simply because, if nothing else, the scriptures are clear that the end is revealed right out of the beginning. And so, if I want to know what's going on in the end, the Father tells me, points me right back to the beginning. So I know that we all worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But there's another seed out there, I believe, that's represented by the God of Cain, Ishmael, and Esau. And the idea is to destroy the good seed revealed in the parable of the wheat and the tares. So from the very beginning, we have a model of the end of how this is going to take place. And I spent a lot of time making the connection of Esau, who's out to destroy Israel, to kill Israel, with the wheat and the tares, and showing how Esau is manifested in various and sundry ways throughout history, and that these Hyksos were the manifestation of Esau and the Edomites coming out of Mount Seir in the east and heading west, and eventually dropping a little bit south into Egypt and invading Egypt at the first Exodus. Most of you listening to my voice, we all understand a greater Exodus, a last Exodus, the second Exodus, whatever term you go by, that we're in the process of right now. And where we're at in this, and how much is left to go, and should we leave and go back to Israel now? We all understand that there's going to be a gathering process taking place. I as well. The question is, do we do it now? Is this the time? And so on and so forth. These are questions that we're all pondering right now. Not just pondering, but these are very serious questions that we need to address. Because historically, preceding the first Exodus, we have these kings of the earth, or these rulers of foreign lands, coming into the, at that time, what was the greatest nation upon the earth. And here now we live in the greatest nation upon the earth. And they come in, not like Westerners with guns ablazing and so forth, but they come in peacefully at first, wanting to trade, want to become part of the culture. And actually, historically, there are a lot of things that we understand about the Hyksos, or these rulers of foreign lands and so forth. Number one, their modus operandi is not to set up a country and establish a capital and have commerce and so forth, and even raise up an army and go out and conquer other nations and make them part of their kingdom and so forth. That's not their modus operandi. They don't operate like Alexander the Great did. But rather, their methodology is to come into other countries, to invade other countries, and set up shop, if you will, within their culture. And this process over time eventually causes that country, that culture, to implode. The other thing we know about these people is that they come in ahead of time. They establish themselves. They have a very spurious background. One of the most well-known characteristics of the Hyksos is, after all this time of studying these people, we still don't know their background. One of the most significant characteristics, they have some kind of a mixed background. Some call them Edomites, such as myself. Some call them Arab. Some call them Hebrew-like. Some call them a combination of Hebrew and Arab. Some say that they were Hurrians. Some say they were Hebrew with a very clear Hurrian background or accent to them. So the point is this: we cannot validate their origin. They're not natural-born citizens of Egypt. They're not natural born citizens of any country they invade, but they have a very spurious background. And when they come into to a culture, they come in peacefully to trade. Over time, they begin to mix in their culture. They enroll in their universities and they drive their camels and they work in their businesses and so forth, and they move into their neighborhoods and they establish themselves as nice neighbors and so forth. But after a while, after there for a while, then they start the process. And that is, first, they begin by organizing in communities and so forth. In other words, they were community organizers. And so they first start out small, of course. They're not like Westerners, come guns a-blazing and so forth. They start out very small. And then they begin to work themselves through the culture. And the next thing you know, they end up owning a lot of the places they used to work at. Now they end up owning a lot of those places. And then after a while, eventually, let's kind of cut to the chase because I have a few things I want to talk about. But eventually, they end up being the pharaoh. They end up being leading the country. They end up being the president of the country, if you will. I believe, as many others do, that the pharaoh that did not know Joseph was an Edomite. He was a Hyksos. And that phrase, he did not know Joseph, in the Hebrew is yada, not da'at. It's not that they didn't have any experiential knowledge of his existence, but it's the Hebrew word yada, which is that intimacy. There was no intimate relationship with Joseph. I should say not. They hated him. The word that's used is satam there in the Hebrew. A vitriolic kind of hate. Of course, there was no intimate relationship with Joseph. Now, there's a lot of things we talked about the Hyksos on the Esau series several years ago. But another couple of things I want to bring out once again is they taught them three things. They taught them, they introduced the chariot, warring machines. They introduced horses into Egypt. As a matter of fact, we understand that they even came into Egypt from the east and the north on horses, on horseback. And they taught them how to make the composite bow. So the relationship of bows and horses and even chariots throughout scripture is also a sign of these people. They were monotheistic. They only worshiped one God. They were not polytheistic like the Egyptian culture that they came in and invaded. Remember, the greatest nation on the earth at that time was very, it was a melting pot, if you will. And they worshiped all kinds of gods there. And so one more God coming into the culture was okay at first. But these guys were monotheistic. There is but one God. And that was also another characteristic of them. And that God's name, that God had a name, and the name was Set. Set. Now, the Set in Hebrew means to run to and fro, to wander, particularly to run to and fro. You can read that in Job chapter 1, verse 5 through 8, in which the sons of God, along with Satan, comes before the presence of God. And if you remember, God asked Satan, well, where did you come from? And he says, from Set, if you will. Actually, it's pronounced shoot there. Running from roaming and wandering to and fro up on the earth. That's the identification of these people once again. They don't establish their own nation and set up a capital and produce an army. They invade other countries and set up within their cultures. That's their nature. Because this all comes from the idea of killing the firstborn. That's the object. See, Israel, remember, Israel is my firstborn. Exodus chapter 4, verse 22, Shemot 4:22. So the object is to kill the firstborn. Well, who's the first one to kill the firstborn? Cain killed Abel. What was the nature of the results of Cain killing Abel? Then he was going to be a fugitive and a vagabond, and no longer would the earth produce from him. And I've gone through all that in the past, but there's a couple other things I want to mention. They were eventually driven off, some historians believe, because they just wouldn't mix with the Egyptian culture. It was okay at first, but after a while, they did not mix. And in rabbinic literature, these Hyksos are called the thorns. The ancient rabbis have seen these people as the thorns. In other words, they use an agricultural term to describe these rulers of foreign lands, these people that come in with the object of ruling your land. And they call them thorns. It's an agricultural picture that's drawn in the parable of the wheat and the tares, once again. In his book, Ages and Chaos, Emmanuel Velikovsky, a very well-known, controversial historian, calls the Hyksos the Amalekites. He believes that historically the Hyksos were the Amalekites. And of course, Amalek was the grandson of Esau. I believe, before I even get into some of these things I want to talk about, I believe that we are seeing the return of the Hyksos. Once again, the object is to come into other countries and then rise up within that system and eventually end up taking it over. It just so happens to be there's a passage in the Quran that states, is in Bukhar 1, Volume 6, that states the following, and I quote, Allah's Apostle, the hour of Allah's Apostle, that is, will not be established until the sun, S-U-N, not S-O-N, but S-U-N, the sun rises up from the west, and when the people see it, whosoever shall be living on the surface of the earth will have faith. Whoever shall see it, those who are living on the surface of the earth will have faith. So this is an identification, a characteristic of Allah's Apostle in the last day, the one that He sent forth. Now, I find it very interesting. I know we've all heard a lot of very interesting things, connections about our current president-elect to a lot of things, and I'm not going to repeat those. But I do want to mention that for some strange reason, I don't know what it is. I'm sure if you asked the Obama campaign, the Obama campaign why they did that, I'm sure they have a very good reason for it. Of course they do. But instead of taking on the campaign plane, instead of taking the traditional symbol of the United States, that would be the flag, the American flag, they removed that and replaced it with a sun rising up over the horizon. That happens to be the symbol that Obama uses in his campaign. Okay, well, enough of that. Those are the things historically that preceded the first Exodus, and I believe that's set up to happen right now. Our concern, your concern, my concern is, how does this relate to the regathering back to the land? Is now the time to go? The biggest concern that I hear voiced to me is that if we don't go now, it may come a time quickly where the door is shut like Noah's Ark, and we can't. We won't be able to leave the United States and won't be able to go back to the land. Since there's a few things that we all agree with, that is that when the Messiah comes, just preceding the Messiah, there's going to be a regathering process for the second time to return the remnant back to the land, and all the tribes will start heading back to the land. And we know that's what we're dealing with here. The question is when and how. That's uppermost on our minds right now, when and how. There's just a couple of things that I want to do that I hope provide a just weight in all of this. Just some suggestions concerning the last times and what's taken place. Now, we know that there are a lot of quote-unquote signs going on around the world. We know that there's wars. We know there's rumors of wars. We know that there's weather phenomena happening. We know the situation going on in Israel right now, that they are established as a state right now. And we know that the volatile situation, particularly as they speak with what's going on in Gaza and so forth, we know that these are all signs coming together in the last days for the regathering. But I'm also going to submit to you, are they? Have the economic woes that the whole world is experiencing right now, and all these things are collectively coming together, is this the sign that it's time to go back into the land, or is it possible that it's just another cycle? I guess I want to submit something to you that I know that I can get seriously criticized for, and that is simply this. What if, just what if, we are continuing to follow the pattern of the last 2,000 years, and once again, we have all these things that seem to be all coming together for just such a time as this for the Messiah to return. But what if we're wrong once again? What if it's possible we're going through another cycle here, and He's not coming back for maybe 10 years or 15 or maybe even 30? I think we all sense that it needs to be in our lifetime. Depends on how old you are right now. But what if... what if the other scenario is that America is simply going down the tubes, imploding, like all other great kingdoms have done in the past, once again, based upon this pattern that we just talked about with the Hyksos? What if that's happening first? What if it's not time to go back to Israel and that would be a mistake to do so? One of the signs, speaking of the word signs, and maybe I just don't get it. Maybe I'm just not with it or whatever, but when I listen to the news or I read something on paper concerning either the economy or global warming, things that are going on with the weather, instead of rattling off a litany of things, let's just take those two for example. The weather and the economy, the economic conditions, because those seem to be two big things that we talk about a lot lately. Seems to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, but when I hear phrases such as this, this is a clue to me of something. And here's how the phrases usually go. See if you recognize this. This is the coldest weather since 19 blah, blah, blah. This is the longest stretch of no rain since blah, blah, blah. This is the highest death rate since, or how about that? This is the worst economy that we've had since. Now, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but when I hear that, what does that kind of tell me? In other words, if we are basing, and I know we should base these things on the signs, I don't think you should eliminate the mathematical aspects of things as well. I think there's going to be a kind of a combination of the two. Most of you know me. To me, it's never a case of it's either this or it's that. But many times I find it to be both. But if we are tying a despicable economy along with the bizarre weather and so forth with the coming of Yeshua, and I know there's a lot more things other than that, I'm just ferreting out these two. If that's the sign, but it was worse at another time, in other words, if this is the worst economy since the Depression of 1929 and in the early 30s, then that suggests to me that it was worse then than it is now. And many economists do indeed say, hey, we're nowhere near where we were in the early 30s. We're nowhere near that. We get Al Gore and all the global warming freaks out there telling us that this or that or this place or that place is the worst since. Now, once again, what does that tell you? That means it was worse at some time in the past. And so why do we not look back and say, well, why didn't he come then if it was worse then than it is now? If that is the indicators, I guess is what I'm saying. Which leads me to my opinion of what I think is going to take place in the next 4 to 6 months here. This is my opinion. I believe that our president-elect right now is going to take office in just a week or so, and he's going to implement and put things into place to recover our economy. Yes, I believe our economy will recover. And because it is a global connection, in other words, the rest of the world is in a great depressing mood right now with respect to the economy, and most people know that it's tied to America. It's tied to this country. And so most people understand that as America goes and the economy, so goes the whole world. And so I believe if he recovers the economy, it's going to affect the whole global economy, and it will begin to go through a restoration process. I hate to use that word with Obama and so forth. But it will go, it will recover, is probably a better word, and that the whole world will tag Obama as being the savior of the world economy. Because, quite frankly, why would we follow? If he comes into office and the economy continues to plummet, how are you going to get the whole world to look at him as a Messiah and a savior, if he indeed is, and that sun that was going to rise up in the West, Allah's apostle in the last days and so forth, if indeed that is true, if he doesn't do anything to cause the people to want to do that. However, if he causes the economy to recover for whatever he does, and it will be 100% artificial, don't get me wrong. It's been artificial as long as I've been alive. Most of us are aware of that. But it will be completely artificial. And he will cause it to recover. Everybody will hail him as the hero of the world. And then sudden destruction is going to happen. That's what I believe is going to happen. And while he's doing that, while he's causing the economy to recover, and which he knows, and the powers that be know, that you can keep the people fat, dumb, and happy. You can do pretty much whatever you want. As long as the people can feel peace and safety. peace and safety through what? They got their house, they got their car, they got their bank accounts, they got their 401s, K's, they've got their snowmobiles, they got all their stuff. It's the economy, stupid. You've heard that before. That's just the way humanity goes, especially in the West, that everybody feels pretty much okay as long as those things are intact. People have no fear. And in the meantime, legislation is going to be passed in this country as if it hasn't already plummeted already, but to cause our morals to continue to plummet so we implode. So we implode. In other words, we collapse from within. And so any nation can come over here and just flick us with their little finger and we'll fall over because we have no infrastructure. Everything in the culture has collapsed from within. Because of our morals. I'm going to submit to you, not because of this or that, but because our morals. If our morals were high, if we stood for what was righteous and holy and good, then I believe God would put favor, would put his hand upon our culture, and no army, no maneuvering in the stock market in Wall Street, none of those things would cause us to fall. We would stand firm. If our morals and our desire to worship our God was intact, he would have his hand upon us. But because we've allowed, once again, our culture to collapse, then that's how we can be defeated militarily. I personally don't believe, whether it's Israel or whether it's America, and we definitely see a connection there, either one of those countries, both of us are trained militarily to be able to withstand another army. I believe we can defeat any army in the world. I really believe that. And I believe Israel's army can as well. But when the enemy is not a traditional enemy, in other words, a standing army against a standing army, which they will be defeated, but when the enemy operates hiding in dens, hiding in schools, hiding in cafeterias and launching rockets from those places, when the enemy is already within your midst and has already set up shop and has already plummeted your resolve in your country, that's when you collapse, that's when you fall. Okay, let me move on. There's three things that I want to mention from my heart with you right now, once again, for those of you who care. There are three things that I believe a prudent man should do and should do right now. Number one, if you're listening to my voice right now and the idea of going back to the land, of being regathered back to the land and not being caught up in a pre-trib rapture or whatever, but the things that are going on right now resonate with you, that we are to keep the Torah, because we love our Savior with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and that he is returning, and he's going to gather us back in the land. If those kind of things, and there's a whole lot more than that, but you know what I'm saying, resonate with you right now, then if you have not already, get connected with a local fellowship now. Don't be a maverick. Go and be part of a group of like-minded believers. I don't care whether it's a building that you go to, it's a church that you rent on Saturdays, or it's just home Bible studies in various places in your neighborhood. Get connected with one of those places. You don't want to be all by yourself when these things begin to take place. And if you're with a group of believers, and you're connected with them and you're taking care of each other, you've made arrangements and preparations to watch over each other, to supply the things that your brother doesn't have that you have, and so on and so forth, that you're all working together with a plan, then if you're wrong, you're all wrong. Because there's nothing worse than being wrong all by yourself. At least if you're wrong, at least you're all wrong and you're part of something. That's the first thing I recommend. Get connected with somebody now. Don't be out there on the end of the limb all by yourself. Number one. Number two, which is kind of connected to number three, if you will. One of the trends I see going on in the Messianic movement or Hebrew roots, whatever, that we just drug from us right out of Christianity, and I believe modern Judaism is just as guilty as of this, and that is the tendency to want to think in an either-or thinking process. Things are either this or and it's either that. And sometimes that is true. There either is a God or there isn't a God, and so on and so forth. But I submit to you that most of the time, both sides have truth to it. And listen very carefully. Don't choose one side and say terrible things about the other. That's the tendency I see us going in, the direction I see us going in already. And I've already seen it in articles and tapes and CDs that I've listened to, that some of you have listened to as well. You got this group over here, if you will, on the right hand, in this corner, if you will, we have those saying, hey, those of you guys over there that are storing up food, and you're trading in your dollars for euros, and you're buying gold and so forth, you guys have no faith. That's not trust in God. Because when the Messiah comes, none of that stuff is going to do you any good. If Yeshua is coming, you're not going to be able to drag all that stuff with you as you go from one place to the next. You're not going to be able to do it. You're fools. And are they right? Yes, they are right. They are right, because the reality is, if the Messiah is coming, if the time has come to get up out of our houses and head back to the land, that's exactly right. All that stuff is not going to do any good as you trek, however that takes place, from one place to another. But on the other hand, we got the other group saying, well, you guys over there are not preparing. You're not preparing for what's going on when these things happen. And because you're not preparing when it happens, don't come looking to us. I've heard that before too. Have any of you heard that? Don't come looking to us for stuff because you didn't prepare. That's not faith. The Bible tells us to prepare, and that's not faith. So each side's accusing the other one of not having faith. Now, is their position correct? Do we need to prepare? Do we need to store up things and be able to survive without the modern conveniences? Absolutely. Absolutely correct. There are two different kinds of scenarios, and I believe a prudent man, a man who is accountable, whether it be a community leader or a leader of a congregation, or it be a husband and a father who's responsible and accountable to a wife and children, a prudent man had better be prepared for both scenarios. Don't choose one and ignore the other. That will be a mistake. If the Messiah is coming, yes, that's true, then have your family or your community of believers ready to go in a moment's notice. I believe Mike Clayton calls it a bug-out bag or something, that you prepare just to get up and go. And you better be prepared for that. However, if the possibility exists, and once again I say if the possibility exists, that he's not coming, that Yeshua's not coming, or perhaps he is, but there's going to be a period of time when we have to live in the wilderness. See, we need to define what living in the wilderness means. And I want to talk about that in the end for a few minutes. I'm just suggesting now the things I think you should do if you are a righteous, prudent man, and because you have an accountability to God for what you do to prepare. Because if Yeshua is not coming next Tuesday, and America is just going to go the way of all other great nations that's gone the way before them, given, you know, their power about 200 plus or minus years. If America is going that direction, where the economy is going to plummet and we're going to be taken back to the, you know, 1800s or whatever, you need to be prepared for that because you have a wife and you have kids. That's why you need to prepare. And so that's a different kind of preparation. I submit that you ought to be able to live without the modern conveniences. And what I mean by that is hot and cold running water coming out of your faucet, electricity, heat, gas, and so forth. You won't have any of those things. In other words, you have to live as if you were living in the wilderness. That's kind of my point. I suggest you be able to do that for a year. That you'd be able to do that for 1 year. Now here's another thing I want to say to congregational leaders, and this is the same with me. I'm not pointing to you. I have to bear the same responsibility. One of the most important things that we're going to have to give an account for, and I'm going to read a couple of verses here. Isaiah chapter 10, verses 1 and 2 is where I want to start. Isaiah 10, verses 1 and 2. We're all familiar probably with the verse in Yaakov or James chapter 1:17, which says that this is pure, undefiled religion. Take care of the widows and orphans. You want pure, undefiled religion, Yaakov says, take care of the widows and the orphans. You and I, as leaders in this, we're going to have to stand before Yahweh one day and we're going to have to give an account for what we did with widows and orphans. Isaiah chapter 10 verses 1 and 2 says, "Woe unto them who decree unrighteous decrees and who write grievousness which they have prescribed, to turn aside the needy from justice and to take away the right from the poor of my people, that widows may be their prey, that they may rob the fatherless." In Acts chapter 6 verses 1 through 3, Acts 6, 1 through 3. You remember? When they assigned leaders to take care of the widows and orphans primarily. It says, "And in those days when the number of the disciples was multiplied, there arose a murmuring of the Grecians against the Hebrews because their widows were neglected in the daily ministration." And so he appoints, seven to take care of them. It was a responsibility they understood they had with wives who have no husbands. And I'm going to submit to you that those who have been divorced also follow in this category. I know technically you'll probably argue, well, their husband didn't die. But I don't think in times like this that we should quibble about the details, whose fault it was and whether it was should have been done this way, whether she's the one that filed or whatever the case may be. You have a woman without a man and you have children without a papa. And those need to be taken care of. We need to make arrangements for them to be prepared as well. So I guess in a nutshell with respect to what I just said, don't choose one scenario or the other. I believe a prudent man would be prepared for both. Be prepared to live in the wilderness, if you will. Now, without having the time to go in a big, long Bible study of wilderness, suffice it to say, the two primary words that are used with respect to being in the wilderness in Hebrew is bamidbar. Of course, that is where he speaks to us as well, bamidbar, and Negev. Negev is translated as south in your scriptures, but it's also translated as fleeing into the wilderness. So it's one of the words used for that. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, if we don't have enough questions going on right now as it is, what constitutes the wilderness? Let me start by asking this. One of the main questions I'm hearing out there is the concern that there's a call to go back to Israel from several different sources, that if this happens and if that takes place and if this goes on and this takes place, that is the sign that you're going to go back to the land. And I'm not doubting that. I'm not here to say that. And what I am saying is this, that the concern that raises is, how do I know specifically for me if it's time to go? Because there's not agreement on this at all within the Messianic community. There's no agreement that we all go running back to land. As a matter of fact, there's 100 different voices coming from 1,000 different directions out there concerning preparation and going back to the land and so forth. So how am I to know? When we think back to the first Exodus, and all things are not equal with the Exodus that we're talking about, the one to come, and being modeled in the first Exodus, because most of us realize that in the first Exodus, one of the significant differences between then and now is that all of Israel was in one place at one time. And that is, and so Egypt represents the whole world, which we are scattered into now. So the whole world still, even though we're not all in one place at one time, we're still in Egypt. No matter where we are in the world, whether we're in America, or whether we're in Great Britain, or whether we're in China or Australia, we're all in this world. The field is the world. Most of us understand that Egypt represents a slavery to the world systems and so forth. We're all in it. So the concern of many people right now, and rightly so, is that if we don't go at such and such a time, then we're afraid that it's going to be too late, the doors are going to be closed, Noah's Ark and so forth, and we're not going to be able to go back to the land. What do we do? Because if that happens, then where do we go from there? What do we do? Let me submit something to you. I submit to you that being in America in a situation, I'm not saying you shouldn't go back to Israel. I'm not going to give that kind of advice. I personally am not going back to Israel right now. But I am saying to you, if the first Exodus is a model, then the whole idea of America shutting the doors and not letting us go back to the land is the situation that we're talking about. When I read all the passages concerning the Father regathering his exiles in the latter days and bringing us back to the land. Many times, here's the things that I read. I read phrases like, I will do this for my glory. My glory will be seen. I will do it right in front of your very eyes. I will gather the assemblies and do it right before you. It will be a glorious thing and so forth. It seems to me that the phraseology that's used around this is very similar to the first Exodus. In other words, it wasn't some, you know, trickling of 9 or 10 people here and doing it on their own and making arrangements and so forth, but rather it was right in front of everybody. It was the Father getting the glory. So the whole world knew that he said, Pharaoh, let my people go, and Pharaoh let them go. So he got the glory so everybody could see in the world, if you will, via television or whatever, could see that he was at work, that the hand of Yahweh was at work in letting the people go. I'm going to submit to you that for those of you who are scared and concerned that that's going to happen, I believe that's the very scenario that the Father is arranging, and so His glory can be seen. I believe that that's exactly what the Father wants to do. Rather than concluding that, well, if we don't go now, then we'll be trapped here in America. I just want to say that that doesn't mean anything's over with. I believe that's the very scenario that he wants us to be in. He wants us to be in that position so he can show the world how he delivered his people out of bondage and slavery. Because we all know that the woman's going to flee in the wilderness and so forth at the same time that these things are happening. The question would be, what is the wilderness once again? Is that the Negev in Israel? Is that a certain patch of land in Jordan where we can all go set up? Or can the wilderness be, I'm just going to submit this to you, can the wilderness be a place where people exist without all the modern conveniences that the system gives us and gets us all wrapped up in? A place in the wilderness where, because we don't have all this stuff cluttering up our lives that we've gotten so used to in America for 200 years now, that we've put on ourselves in a position of preparing to be in a wilderness. So we got all the quietness and the stillness of being in the wilderness so the Father can speak to us. That's what I'm going to submit to you. Is it possible that the wilderness, before the actual regathering, before His arm actually gathers us back and physically takes us there, how that's going to happen? There's a number of scenarios. I'm not a wizard. I don't know how that's going to happen. All I know is He's going to make a highway for the remnant to come back to the land. How that's going to take place, I don't know. But meanwhile, wandering in the wilderness, is it possible that He's speaking to our hearts right now and saying, get out of the system that you find yourself trapped in. Get out of the cities. Get out of a scenario in which you are forced to have to depend on the system in order to eat and to drink and to have food and so forth. Get out of that. Because if the mark of the beast, if it is something arranged by the enemy himself, where unless you take it, you have no way of buying and selling things. You have no way of getting all these things that we've always been used to. Then what that tells me simply is that if you are not prepared to live without all these things in the system, then you're going to end up taking the mark, and so you can eat, and so you can have all this food on your table, and so you can live life as you've always lived it. But if you don't take it, and you've prepared yourself to be able to live without those things, that to me is what the wilderness could very much be all about. That's basically what I wanted to say about that. As I move in, I'd like to conclude with this. Between now and that time, I believe the Father told us that until He returns, that we should occupy ourselves. One of the biggest mistakes, and I've said this many times in conferences in the past several years, in my frustration, what I see happening in the Hebrew Roots movement is something that was a big part of Christianity when I was heavily involved in that. And that is so absorbed with what's in the future which is still unclear, to the corruption of our present system, which I believe is very clear. I believe generation after generation after generation, especially in Western countries, have gone by, seen morals plummet slowly but surely. A whole paradigm shift in what even is moral or immoral has also taken place slowly but surely, tick by tick over time, because from a religious point of view, the light of the world, which we're supposed to be, was so totally focused on prophecy, and I'm not saying that that is important, please don't get me wrong, but I'm saying so focused on the idea of prophecy being preparing for his return, that we've let our cultures around us collapse. And you and I are going to have to give an account for that. I ask you, is it that kind of bride that Yeshua is coming for, that's got its eschatology right, has got the correct prophetic scenario all laid out with all the numbers and all the dates lined up here and so forth? Is that the kind of bride he's looking for, that's got all that down? Not that there's anything wrong with that, don't get me wrong. But the emphasis on that and the obsession with some people. I run into people who have tied their salvation onto the correct prophetic scenario. They've tied salvation to that. In other words, if you don't believe that, you're not really saved. I am serious as I can be. There are people out there like that. And like I said, meanwhile, we continue to lead the world in abortions and pornography and murder and suicide and drugs, children out of wedlock, and any one of a number of things that you can think of. We're supposed to be a light to the world. What about that? I believe we're going to have to give an account for that. We still need to be about the business of standing for what is right and righteous and holy and good from the Father's eyes in our culture. I believe we're still responsible to turn our world upside down. I don't think that went out the window. And I'm not encouraging people to disregard prophetic events. I'm not saying that. Please don't let us be guilty of another generation of which our morality went down the proverbial tubes. And then I believe that there will be a time soon when, as you and I prepare to not need the system, that we will flee. Because we don't want to fight the system. Because according to the scriptures, we're going to lose that fight. You've heard it said before, those who take up the sword will die by the sword. We're not going to win fighting the system when that time comes. And I believe because we are in that stage right now where we are preparing ourselves not to need the system. I don't need your stuff, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I still think we need to be a bride preparing for a bridegroom, continuing to make ourselves spotless and without blemish so we can stand before him looking like someone anybody would want to marry. Well, I suppose I've babbled enough. Those are the kind of the things that I wanted to say. I don't think I said them as well as I wanted to say them, but I hope I got some things across. I really want to close with this because one of the things I do not want to see being prevalent within the body of Yeshua right now is fear. Fear. I believe that's one of the tactics of the enemy, is knowing the ramifications of a person or a group of people that act out of fear, rather than knowing that we can trust in our Father. Trusting in our Father doesn't mean that we just kind of go on with life and do whatever we want to and he'll just kind of take care of us. That's not what I'm saying. But we do need to know that we are children of the King and that he loves us so. And he's preparing us, because any father would prepare his children for what's coming. And so when that happens, he's already told us that if we will trust in him, no weapon formed against us shall prosper. Every tongue that shall rise against you in judgment, you shall condemn. And this is the heritage, he says, of the servants of Yahweh, and their righteousness is from me, saith Yahweh. For you are my portion, Yahweh, and I have said that I would keep your words. I entreated your favor with my whole heart. Be merciful unto me according to your word, for I think on your ways, and I have turned my feet into your testimonies, and I will make haste and delay not to keep your commandments. For the bands of the wicked have robbed us, but I and you and me, we have not forgotten your Torah. And at midnight I will rise to give thanks unto you because of your righteous ordinances. For I am a companion of all those who fear you and of those who keep your precepts. The earth, Yahweh, is full of your mercy. Teach me your statutes. Him and in him alone shall we fear. There's nothing that Wall Street, nothing that the market can do, nothing that the system can do that's going to take me down or you down. Please, let's trust in him. For whatever that was worth, thanks for listening to me babble for a while. Shalom Aleichem.